finale. Programming on NPR is supported in part by News Radio 1330, WMNN, providing quick news, weather, and traffic updates at 1330 a.m., complementing the in-depth news and analysis on NPR.
Good morning. Welcome to Mid-Morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer. Representative Mindy Greiling's first encounter with the state mental health system was a bruising one, as she and her husband fought last summer to have their 21-year-old son involuntarily committed for what was later diagnosed as possible drug-induced psychosis. Her own struggles to bring her son to help has prompted her legislative proposal that would make it easier to commit people who need treatment but don't want it. It's a question that's being looked at across the nation as advocates for the mentally ill examine how the rights and the health of patients can best be balanced. Could involuntary commitment be abused? Can you make it too easy to commit people? We'll look at that question today with Representative Mindy Greiling. She's a state representative from Roseville. She joins us in the studio. Thanks for coming by.
Good morning.
And also we'll be talking to Cynthia Nugent Hart. She's a member of the State Advisory Council on Mental Health. She also joins us in the studio. Thanks for doing so.
Good morning.
Representative Greiling, let's start with you. How hard is it to involuntarily commit someone?
Well, Catherine, I think that depends on a few factors. For us, it was a bruising process, as you said, but it actually worked pretty well as the system ever works, because our son did meet the state standard of being dangerous to others. You have to be either dangerous to self or others. There's a third criteria of being unable to provide for yourself. With the amount of homeless we have, that one clearly isn't used very often. But for people who go through commitment whose loved one does not meet the standard of dangerousness, it can be a very difficult process. Usually they're not even recommended to go through it by the professionals who know how time-consuming that process is. So they are turned away, the person sent right back home again, and there they are with huge suffering on the part of families. Sometimes the professionals do recommend the commitment process, and even then the families are turned away.
Before we go much further, I think it's worthwhile to explain to everyone what commitment is.
Well, commitment is when you go in front of a judge, and the judge and attorneys on both sides provided by the county at taxpayer expense try to decide if the person meets the standard of imminent danger to self or others. You need to be about ready to imminently hurt someone or hurt yourself, suicidal and so forth. And if those standards are met, then you are, I consider it a criminal model, because it's akin to being sentenced to 6 months of involuntary care. It doesn't have to be that full amount. It could be up to 6 months. And you could get a stay where you can be out in the community, or you could be sent to a regional treatment center or some other type of hospital where you are treated by psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers for your mental illness so that you can get better.
All right. Cynthia Nugent Hart, just want to check in with you. Does that track with your definition of commitment?
Well, I would add one additional clause to that. The commitment law also says that one can be committed if they're unable to take care of their basic needs. So it is not only the dangerousness or risk of dangerousness, and I want to make it clear that it's not a requirement that people actually commit a dangerous act towards themselves or others in order to be committed.
But it strikes me, Mindy Greiling, that you would argue that if you have committed a dangerous act, I mean, my understanding is that you think that the commitment law as it works now really only works if you have committed violence.
Or Catherine, if you're about to, but
well, that's a sort of nebulous, isn't it?
Exactly. Therein lies the problem. And, I have many examples, because I've had so many calls after this has been in the newspapers from people across the state where they have, the court has misjudged that the person was imminently dangerous, and then terrible tragedies occurred.
Cynthia Nugent Hart, do we need a change in the commitment law?
No, we do not need a change in the commitment law that makes it easier to commit people. The organizations that are opposing Mindy Greiling's bill are doing so because of the language in the particular bill she's introduced, not because we oppose her overall intention of helping people get treatment earlier. The problems in the bill that she's introduced are that the bill would permit coerced treatment if a person with mental illness refuses appropriate treatment and the treatment is needed to prevent further progression of the illness. It's our belief that this really casts far too broad a net and, in fact, is probably unconstitutional. Literally, a disagreement about treatment could be construed as refusal, and there's no showing of present or even future likelihood of dangerousness and no showing of incapacity to make a rational decision that's required with the language she's proposing.
I'm going to interject here, because this this particular debate can get so complicated so quickly. My understanding is that, for instance, with schizophrenia, which often comes on, if you could, the belief is now with schizophrenia, it hits worst, I guess, between ages 15 and 30, mm-hmm. that if you catch it early, you can stop the progress of it. You can stop it from getting any worse. So wouldn't that, as we make new discoveries, wouldn't that make it... I can certainly understand a family member feeling more urgency. My goodness, if I can get my young person, if I can get my 20-something child into treatment now, I could be sparing them many years of pain.
Well, this is not a debate about the merits of early mm-hmm. intervention, mm-hmm. because there is clearly no dispute in any part of the mental health community about the desirability of that. This is a debate about whether making it easier to commit people is the way to accomplish that earlier intervention.
Well, then let me turn to Mindy Greiling, because one of the questions I have is commitment the only way to make sure that someone gets treatment who doesn't necessarily want?
Well, I would say that this is definitely a debate about early intervention, because according to the Treatment Advocacy Center, it's an adjunct of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, up to 50% of people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder do not ever recognize that they have an illness. We had Dr. Floyd Anderson from the Minnesota Psychiatric Society, who said two-thirds of people who have schizophrenia are questionable whether they have insight into their illness, and the other one-third have absolutely no recognition of their illness. So this is a huge problem. If you're going to get early intervention for people who don't recognize that they have an illness, then you have to go through some kind of legal process. In this state, it's the commitment process to get them care. This is absolutely a discussion about early intervention.
One of the things that strikes me is that your son went through at least three diagnoses as you were trying to get him help. Does that make you leery at all? Here we are saying we need to make it easier to commit people who need help but don't want it, and yet we're dealing with a field where someone in 6 months can be told that they have perhaps the early signs of schizophrenia, and then maybe it's bipolar, and then it's psychosis, and then, well, maybe it's drug-induced psychosis. That would make me leery.
It's leery to know what the label is, but to me the label isn't important. Everyone agreed that we had a huge problem with a huge sickness that our son had. So the labeling is not as important as getting the early help. And the fact that we didn't have a label meant that we were getting early help. If you wait around till you have a diagnosis, which can take years, you've already missed the chance to stop that fire in the brain, which is destroying brain cells, which is what psychosis is.
Cynthia Nugent-Hart?
Well, I think it's really important, again, if we're talking about using commitment as the method of providing early intervention, that we really need to look at the long-term impact of commitments. And it has a profound impact on for the rest of the lives for individuals who are committed. It will make them more resistant to coming forward for treatment, because it really destroys the trust between that individual and their provider. It makes the system more coercive, which makes them more fearful that if they come forward again, they'll be committed yet again. People have actually committed suicide out of fear of returning to the hospital. So I think it's not a we fix one thing here, but there's no negative impact on the other side. But the most important thing is that we have to look at the effectiveness of commitment. And there's a study called the Bellevue Study that is found in comparing those subjected to outpatient commitment with comparing them with those who are offered the same intensive services, that there's no additional improvement in patient compliance, no increase in continuation of treatment, and no difference in rates of hospitalization, length of hospital stay, or arrests and violent acts that are committed. So I think there's a real problem in using the Commitment Act because of what we know about the harmful effects of it.
So how do you get someone who doesn't recognize that he or she is sick, who doesn't want to take medication, how do you get them to do that?
Well, in reality, we're always, with the current state of the science, going to miss that with a certain number of individuals. But in reality, when you look at a number of the tragedies that have occurred and we analyze very carefully the situations that led up to them, usually we find that much earlier in the course of the illness or the progression of the disease that there were opportunities for the system to intervene, for medicine to intervene, and there were serious gaps and failures in how we responded. So essentially we, in our failure to provide appropriate services, allowed the deterioration to occur to the point that there was a much higher risk of dangerousness.
Under your bill, Representative Greiling, how do we identify who gets committed? It strikes me that checkoff list is going to be very important.
It's very important, and that's where we have to be very careful. But we would continue on with the same process of having the actual doctors make the decision. They have to decide that the person has a mental illness, that they do not want to voluntarily agree to treatment, and they also have to have grossly disturbed behaviors and perceptions. So they have to meet all those criteria, and then on top of that, now we're adding a new criteria where the proposed patient is in need of treatment and their disease is likely to progress. That's the language that, you know, is the $64,000 question here. And what we're trying to do is focus on their need for medical care rather than proving that they're imminently dangerous. And that is focusing on what I call a medical model rather than this criminal model that we have. The whole process right now is focused on the dangerousness. And Cindy says, you know, the unable to provide and so forth, but that criteria is rarely used. In order to have that kick in for our son, we would have had to kick him out of the house in his very, very dangerous state to himself or others, and then hope that he didn't feed himself. And he was, you know, he was functioning very high on a high level in terms of succeeding on the street. He wasn't unable to function.
Well, and I just would like to point out the language issue. Representative Greiling has said that the other component to the bill is that one has to exhibit grossly disturbed behavior and faulty perceptions. It's or faulty perceptions. I think the general public would maybe better understand our objection if, instead of mental illness, if you substituted a non-compliant diabetic, someone, a chronic smoker with lung disease who is non-compliant with treatment, who has maybe faulty perceptions, which I think continuing to smoke is a faulty perception, and whose disease would progress without treatment, you can see that we could be committing almost anybody, and therein lies the problem with the language of the bill.
We are talking to Cynthia Nugent-Hart. She's a member of the State Advisory Council on Mental Health, and we're talking to Mindy Greiling. She's a state representative from Roseville who has proposed legislation that would make it easier to commit people who need treatment, medical treatment for their mental illness, but don't want to get it. We'd like to have you join the conversation now. 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828. Maybe you have your own family story that gives you an approach on this problem. Maybe you have your own concerns about whether we're making it too easy, too hard to commit someone. Are you seeing a pendulum swing from the reforms of the 70s when it comes to how we treat commitment and mental illness? Join our conversation. It's 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Mindy Greiling, I think that obviously there's a lot of things that intersect on this issue, but I think when you get down to the wanting to help someone who's ill versus not trampling on their civil rights, how does your bill protect that? That strikes me as being one of the main criticisms from those mm-hmm. who oppose it.
And we still have the legal processes in here. And I'd like to add and give a lot of credit to Senator Don Betzold, who's working on this with me. He's a marvelous resource for me and for everyone who's interested in this issue, because he is an attorney who in his professional life specializes in representing and defending the rights of those who have a mental illness and go through the commitment process. He's done that for years and years. He's considered the legislative expert in civil commitment for those who have a mental illness. So he is very cognizant, and I myself, being a civil libertarian type, are very particular that there still have to be rights of individuals. So that is something that we put at paramount interest. There's still every legal protection for what we're working on as there is with the current commitment process. And I would like to clarify that what we're doing is a different cat than the regular commitment process. We're not trying to get more people committed for the old-fashioned commitment. We're leaving that you do have to be dangerous to self or others or unable to function. We're working on the section of law that's called early intervention. It came out of the Sandra Gardebring Supreme Court Task Force, and it's trying to get early intervention that's more focused on community care, outpatient care, and up to a short term, up to 30 days of hospitalization, and then out into the community. So we're thinking that this is a middle ground. It's not the lock them up and throw away the key mentality of the 50s and 60s. It's not the do nothing with them and look the other way unless they become dangerous mentality of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. This is a middle ground that I think we should take a serious look at.
You know, I need to interject. The way you've been characterizing the reforms of the 70s and 80s, there were some good reforms there that were correcting excesses of before. So to simply say, oh, well, we looked the other way, that's not quite fair, is it?
Well, I think that we had a great expectations in those days. And I would say my grandmother was in the Rochester State Hospital in those days, and I was very aware of how easily it was to commit her. So I know those driving in the station wagon on the way to the hospital days. She actually did have a fair, but she had some sort of a trial and was arrested by the sheriff and all those horrible things of those days. But when everyone was let out, pretty much in the 50s and 60s and 70s, the whole grand plan, and here I think Cindy and I would agree absolutely, was to go to putting that money into community resources. And that just never happened. It was a false promise. That money was, quote, saved, unquote. And we really have this dearth of care then. And I think when we go to work for community care, all the advocacy groups will be lined up together and have been lined up together, but not as successfully so as all of us would like.
I made a point on the Friday night show that Mindy and I were on that one of the reasons we oppose the lowering of the standards so much for commitment is because of the tremendous gaps today in community-based services. Mindy, Representative Greiling responded at that occasion that she thought it was unethical to use that rationale as a reason not to do this earlier intervention. I really strongly disagree with that assertion, because I think it's irresponsible of us not to, when we're talking, we are a nation founded on personal liberty, and to curtail those personal liberties as commitment does, I think it's irresponsible of us not to examine all of the dynamics and forces that really led to the inevitability of that commitment and the harm that it might do. I think making it easier to commit people is an easy way out of system problems. It's easier to trample on the rights of a vulnerable population than it is to take on the insurance industry, the state and county government, and the state employee unions, which are really our challenges in the political reform that we need to enhance community-based services.
Representative Briley.
Thank you. I would just like to agree with my earlier statement that I do think it is unethical to have choices made that have to do with services available. Cindy makes the assertion that because we don't have enough services for people who go voluntarily and therefore they're sometimes encouraged to be committed to get services, I think that's wrong. But I don't think it's a logical next step then to assume that because there's not enough care for the voluntary, we should ration out or curtail care for the involuntary. I don't think it's coercion or being mean to someone to get the medical care when they can't make that decision with their own brain that is ill. I think it's kind and helpful.
We're going to go to Pete in St. Paul. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Yes. Can you hear me, Catherine?
I sure can.
Great. This is a wonderful and important show, and I've had a chance to work both with Representative Grayling and Cindy Hart, and they're both very sincere folks. I've personally experienced the commitment process twice. Once when I was a teenager, when it wasn't appropriate, and I didn't receive good care or respect, and it almost destroyed me. But I also went through the commitment process when I was 30, when it was appropriate, and I did receive wonderful care and respect, and it saved my life. I think that the crux of this issue, though, is, and I know that family members and our legislators are really concerned about getting us the care that we need, but as someone who has struggled for 30 years with depression, the crux of this issue is why we don't seek help. And Mindy brought up something that was very important with people with schizophrenia, sometimes that they don't know that they are ill. But for me, and in the case of so many of the people that I know, the treatment that we need is simply not available, that you need to either be destitute or wealthy to afford it, or else the main thing is the stigma that exists around this disease is so powerful that we're afraid to seek get care. I know that the lesson that I've gotten in my life is that I have multiple sclerosis, which is a disease of the nervous system, but I also have this depression, which is a disease of the brain. And people are always stunned when I tell them that even though my MS has taken away the use of my legs and I'm going blind, my depression is by far the more terrible of the two, that while my MS destroys my body, the depression goes after my soul. But the thing is that my MS is a politically correct disease, and no one has ever judged me for it or thought less of me for having it. But even with the medical breakthroughs showing that brain disorders, mental illness, are also physical brain diseases, not unlike Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, it still comes with a stigma, this myth, this lie, that it's not a real disease, that the fault lies with the person himself, and that it is his inherent weakness or laziness or flaws of character that are responsible. These are some of the educational issues that I would hope that Representative Grayling would look at in terms of the future, that a dollar spent in educating people about the disease and in eliminating this mark of disgrace that we unfairly carry is going to save $1,000 down the road.
So, Pete, so where do you stand on the question of commitment? Do you think that we need to make it harder, easier?
What I think we need to do is to make the care available and the education there. The focus has always got to be on the word care, not on commitment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know from my own experience that how terrible this is, disease, that there's nothing worse. As I said, going blind is a piece of cake compared with being depressed. But the answer is not to force people into treatment. The answer is to let them not have this terrible fear about the disease that they have so that they will voluntarily seek treatment. The whole difference between 30 years ago and now is that I don't have shame about my depression, is that if I know that I'm getting depressed, if I feel those symptoms, I go to the doctor just as I would my multiple sclerosis.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that when I have something wrong with my MS or if I've got a sore throat, I call the doctor, there's a little bit of a hassle, sometimes not, and I go and I get to see the doctor. With my depression, with mental health issues, it's not the same thing. The health is not available. We have to jump through so many hoops to get the simplest help that we need. And with this disease, you feel so fatigued and so beat down, it's sometimes hard to jump through those hoops without help. The whole key is care. And what stops people is that they either don't understand that they're ill or that they can't get the help that they need, or that because of this stigma that they're going to be fired, that they're going to face social disrepute, that they're going to face financial hardships, stops them from getting the help that they need. The other thing that I would also encourage is that the whole mental health community needs to always work together for the main cause, and that this is a potentially divisive issue. We need to keep our eyes on the prize and work for the larger goal of helping folks that have this disease.
Pete, I thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Representative Grayling.
Pete is one of the most eloquent spokespersons for advocating for better care for people who have a mental illness, and I have to compliment him for all his work going to churches and speaking out everywhere, and he is just excellent. He makes wonderful points. I agree with his points about the stigma and having better care and better access. Where I think maybe we differ, I couldn't really tell because I thought he said more than one thing, but commitment at one point saved his life, I've heard him say, and freedom to suffer is not a freedom at all. But he has suffered from depression. That is not one of the mental illnesses that where you don't recognize that you're ill. And so I'm glad that he also acknowledges that people with bipolar disorder and people who have schizophrenia are the ones who don't recognize that they're ill, and there has to be a place for that too. But I agree that this is a small part of the whole picture of what needs to be worked on.
Go ahead, quickly.
Well, I'd just like to quickly make a comment about folks who don't recognize that they're ill. I think it's important to recognize that that's usually not a continuous, all-the-time state of affairs, and then that there are ways to work with people who are having trouble accepting that they're ill and still convince them to accept treatment. I have neglected to mention I also am a family member and so have some experience with my brother who ultimately commits suicide and my son in really talking and working with someone, trying to instill in them the notion that they have some control in their own recovery and that there's a need to make good decisions, that you can bring people who are resistant to the diagnosis and resistant to the treatment to accept it.
We are talking to Cynthia Nugent-Hart. She's a member of the State Advisory Council on Mental Health, and to Mindy Greiling. She is a state representative from Roseville. We'd love to be talking to you as well about this proposal to make it easier to commit people with mental illnesses who need medical treatment but don't want to seek it. It's 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning. We're going to turn now to Marianne Sullivan. She's standing by with the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.
Good morning, Catherine. In the news this Monday morning, stocks aren't following their recent pattern so far today on Wall Street, where the Dow is higher, but the NASDAQ Composite Index has opened lower. Last week, investors moved away from blue chips and into tech stocks, causing the Dow to move below 10,000 for the first time since April. John McCain is in Pat Robertson territory today in Virginia Beach, Virginia. He's lashing out at Robertson's ties to George W. Bush. McCain says religious conservatives who back Bush are simply trying to hold on to their own power. Despite his victories in Arizona and Michigan primaries, McCain isn't gaining any ground on George W. Bush in California. A new poll finds he's still trailing Bush by 20 points in the state. Amadou Diallo's mother says her son was forgotten during the trial of four police officers accused of murdering him. She tells NBC no one talked about him. Protests continue over the acquittal of the four white officers on all charges in the case. The chairman of Minnesota's DFL party, Mike Erlandson, says former Congressman Tim Penny won't run for the U.S. Senate race this year. Penny represented the first congressional district in southeastern Minnesota from 1982 through 1994. He left saying he was disappointed with politics and the budget process. Governor Ventura tried to recruit Penny to the Reform Party to challenge first-term Republican incumbent Senator Rod Grams, but Penny decided to remain a Democrat. Late last year, more than 90 activists announced the creation of People for Penny to encourage him to enter the race. Penny isn't talking publicly today, but he issued a statement which his campaign manager, Sean McDonough, read. Penny says in the statement that he's letting the race pass him by for strictly personal reasons. The latest forecast of state revenues is due out at the Capitol this week, and lawmakers from both political parties expect it to show the state with yet another budget surplus. Legislators will use the forecast, which is set to be released tomorrow, to set their final tax and spending bills of the session. Wind advisory for parts of southwest and west central Minnesota through early evening. In the Twin Cities, windy, warm, and sunny with a high in the 50s. Catherine, that's the latest from the newsroom. I'm Marianne Sullivan.
Programming on NPR is supported by Care 11 News, featuring award-winning photojournalism and community involvement. The news handled with care. Enjoy the treasures of Europe this spring with Minnesota Public Radio's Magic of Music Tour of Italy, April 27th through the 7th of May. This 9-day trip includes stops in Milan and Venice with fabulous concerts, including baritone Thomas Hampson with the Orchestra of Florence. The package also includes airfare, lodging at 4- and 5-star Italian hotels, meals, and more. For information and reservations, call 1-800-228-7123. Or check out our website at mpr.org.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. You're listening to Mid-Morning here on Minnesota Public Radio. We're continuing our conversation with Mindy Greiling, a state representative from Roseville, who has a proposal in the legislature to make it easier to commit people with mental illness who refuse treatment. And we're also talking to Cynthia Nugent-Hart. She's a member of the State Advisory Council on Mental Health. And, of course, we'll be talking to you, 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000. Cynthia Nugent-Hart, I want to get back to something you said right before we did that break for the news. You talked about how in your family you had a brother, you had a son who also grappled with mental illness. Your brother, you said, committed suicide. Now, here we have legislation that is informed by Representative Greiling's experience with her son, and we have you and your experience. It strikes me that in this debate, people often go to the anecdotal. I mean, they go to what they know and their experience. Is there any way to take this debate and lift it above what you've gone through yourself? It just strikes me that very humanly, very naturally, we all extrapolate from what we've been through.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, that's a difficult thing to do, to rise above your experience, and clearly both of our personal experiences have motivated each of us to become very active in this arena. I think it's essential that one take enough time to truly understand all the complexities of how the private and public healthcare systems intersect to either accomplish what we hope to accomplish or provide barriers to what we hope to accomplish. And I think that takes a lot of time. I've been an advocate and a member of the State Advisory Council for 10 years. And I think what I've learned in terms of the perversity of how we fund mental health services and the disincentives to do the right thing that exist in the structure of how we fund is probably fundamentally at the basis of my reluctance to talk about making it easier to commit people.
Am I hearing veiled criticism that perhaps Representative Greiling hasn't studied this issue long enough?
She has worked diligently to really listen, and has, I give her a lot of credit for how much time she has spent looking at this issue. But in fact, she's only been looking at it for a few months, less than a year at this point, and I spent this weekend calling people, reading things, refreshing my memory, making sure I had facts straight. It's just extremely difficult to really master all of the dynamics that are involved in a short period of time.
Representative Greiling, are we looking here at legislation by personal anecdote?
Absolutely not. And, you know, Catherine, one of the luxuries of being a legislator is that you can summon and call, and they actually come, all the experts of the state. And Senator Betzel and I have spent several months meeting with the top-level people who do know a lot more than either one of us, certainly than I. The people, we went to the VA hospital and met with the psychiatrist there. They said our laws in this area are archaic and outdated, and they could do much better by the veterans of the state if we made changes along this line. We met with the Minnesota Psychiatric Society, the psychologists, the state organization, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, who, by the way, the Minnesota chapter has voted to endorse this legislation, the Minnesota BioBrain Association, where they spend their lives and their days talking to family after family after family. They have been actually the catalyst and the driving force for my working on this. If I had only gone with my own little experience and went off half-cocked, I would say that it would be a valid criticism, but we've gone to the experts across the state who have worked with this for years, and they are anxious for some changes.
We're going to go to Janice in Anoka. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I am an assistant county attorney who's been working in the area of mental health care and civil commitment since 1984. And was also on the Civil Commitment Task Force with Senator Betzel. So I guess I have a lot of anecdotes that lead to my thoughts and opinions. I agree with what everybody said, that we need much more funding for outpatient care, and we need to make sure that those people who want to volunteer for treatment have that treatment available and don't deteriorate to the point that commitment's necessary because of the fact that treatment wasn't available. That's a travesty when that happens. But I do think there are two groups of people who can and should be brought under the umbrella of court-ordered treatment, whether it's inpatient or outpatient, without violating the Constitution. One of those groups are persons who are not violent, living in households, being cared for by their families, who would not be able to function if their families were to turn them out. And statute currently says, in addition to being able to commit a mentally ill person who is in danger of physically harming self or others, that if the person fails to provide food, clothing, shelter, or medical care, that the person can be committed. The problem is the word fail as opposed to the word unable, because parents will say to me on the phone, the only reason my child is eating or sleeping in a bed is I'm putting food in front of him and I'm supplying him the bed. If I didn't have my 30-year-old son in my house, he couldn't survive. But how can I be expected to turn him out? And so they don't turn them out, and he deteriorates. And sometimes it takes very long before he gets violent and meets the other criteria. Sometimes he never meets the other criteria.
So, Janice, because we have so many calls to get
okay.
to, you're saying that there are population groups who could be served by this proposal?
Absolutely. And I'm not sure whether or not Mindy's proposal necessarily meets what I think is appropriate, and I think it could be looked at again or fine-tuned to make sure that it's constitutional. I'm not supporting Mindy's proposal in particular, but just saying that there are population groups that could be benefited by an expanded definition of who meets criteria. Can
okay.
I say just briefly the one other group?
You better make
I think,
it brief.
Okay. The other group is people who engage in criminal behavior, but the criminal behavior does not involve physically harming other persons. There are persons who engage in property destruction, theft, robbery, and so on, and we are unable to force civil commitment treatment on those persons because they don't meet current criteria.
Janice, I thank you for your
okay.
call.
Thank you.
Cynthia Nugent-Hart.
Well, I would I think we can have many more discussions about the two populations that the caller has identified. I think it's important to note that Representative Greiling's bill casts a much broader net than the very specific examples that we were just given. I also want people to know that the current language that she's proposed is opposed by the Mental Health Association, the State Advisory Council, the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Mental Retardation, the Disability Law Project, and the Consumer Survivor Network. These are all organizations who clearly cannot be accused of being insensitive to the needs of folks with mental illness. Also, when she said that NAMI of Minnesota voted to support her bill unless they took a vote this weekend in an unplanned meeting, they have clearly supported her intention to address this problem, but they have not taken any formal board action to support the language of this bill.
Well, I have to interject here. They are so anxious for this proposal that sight unseen they did vote to endorse the legislation, but at the last board meeting, we went through the bill line by line by line. I'm a new member of that board. That was my first meeting, and I heard no objection whatsoever to the language. But I will also say that I'm not locked into this language. This is our first run up the flag. Senator Betzold and I wanted to get something out there, and we're very open to refining the language, making sure it's constitutional. This is going to be dealt with next year.
We're going to go to Kim in Brooklyn Park. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi there.
Hi.
I've been listening with great interest to the program. I've been interested in this issue since I first heard it come up, and I have no doubt in my mind that it's extremely painful for family members and friends to watch a person who does have a mental illness go through that and to refuse treatment for whatever reason. But despite the fact that I don't have any doubts about that, I think it's very important that we remember that the Bill of Rights guarantees people certain freedoms, and that those freedoms aren't designed, to prevent the pain of family members. There are a lot of things that individuals do that are difficult for others to watch, which was brought up also by your guest, things like comparing it to conventional medical treatment for physical illnesses, and that we cannot coerce people or force them to have medical treatment. I myself, in the past, have had periods of severe depression, and I have refused any kind of treatment for that. I think that under the guidelines that the legislator is recommending, might have been possible for my family to have me committed, and I do not think that would have been appropriate. I found a different way to approach the depression. I took a much more spiritual approach, which is personal to me, and I wouldn't have wanted to be kind of forced or coerced to do what the current medical community determines to be the appropriate treatment, and I think it's important that people have that choice.
Kim, I thank you for your call.
Thank you.
We're going to go to Mike in New Brighton. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I speak as someone who has gone through this, and I'm currently going through the commitment process with my 19-year-old daughter, so I have some experience in this.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I wanted to mention is Cynthia Nugent Hart said that she has seen people commit suicide rather than go back to treatment. And I would argue that anyone who commits suicide rather than going back to treatment, it's very possible that that person should have never been released from treatment anyway, or in the first place, because they were not mentally healthy enough. There seems to be, and again, I'm speaking from experience, a rush to get people out. I've had a daughter that came very close to suicide, 10 days of treatment, like 2 hours a day. She's ready to come home, they said. And we're right back into it again. I have another hearing, commitment hearing, probably this Wednesday. But you've got a medical system that can recommend very highly certain modes of treatment, and then you have a legal definition that says least restrictive rules, and the medical community may agree, four doctors may agree, this person needs 3 months of intensive therapy to even survive because they're so suicidal. Then the legal community or the courts say, because of the state law, she's going to get 10 days because otherwise it would be too restrictive, and then they're back out on the street and possibly very suicidal. Also, she said, people eventually realize that they're sick. And I can tell you, after 4 years, my daughter still refuses to believe that she has anything, that she has any mental illness. Yet, when things get tough for her, when her consequences start building up, she's ready to pull the plug on her life again. I would not define her as a mentally healthy person.
Mike, we'll have Cynthia Nugent Hart respond, and we wish you well. Wish you
Thank
luck.
You.
All right.
Yeah, I'm very aware of the pain and the difficulties that this gentleman is referring to. I think it's important to understand that one example that he gave in terms of the short hospitalizations is a large part of what's driving some of our problems today. And that problem really goes back in part to changes that the federal government made in the mid-80s in terms of diagnostic-related groups and much shortened inpatient stays that are now allowed in the community. We used to be able to not talk about committing people in the mid-80s until they'd been in the hospital for a couple of months. Now we have insurance companies who basically use the dangerousness standard in the commitment law as their criteria in terms of whether or not to let someone get into the hospital at all, which is inappropriate and should be against the law. We also then have institutions, because they know they're only going to be getting paid for 7 to 10 days, making an assessment the minute you walk in the door about whether or not they're going to be able to stabilize you in that short period of time, and then initiating commitment proceedings if they think it's going to take longer than 7 to 10 days. Coupled with, we have the state hospitals, who are the only place you can get long-term inpatient care anymore, who tell people that they have to be committed to come there. And I would like to also point out to the caller that there is no state law that says that you have to be discharged within 10 days. So whoever told you that is unfortunately giving you inaccurate information.
One of the changes that we have in this legislation is to go from 10 days to 30 days for early intervention of care in the hospital. I would add, though, that the groups who are opposing it are opposed to that increased amount of time. So I think there's a little bit of doublespeak here.
And what is the influence of the insurance companies?
I would agree with all the problems with insurance companies, in the sense that they, of course, for all illnesses, but especially for mental illness, are trying to pay as little as possible. They see that if they really had to add in care for people who have a mental illness, they see that as costing a lot more. Actually, people like Mike Christensen from Allina, with the head of the foundation, who really have looked into this, understand that early intervention, early care would actually save them money. So I hope that people, enlightened thinkers like him and others, will enter this debate.
We are talking to Mindy Greiling. She's a state representative from Roseville, and to Cynthia Nugent Hart. She's a member of the State Advisory Council on Mental Health. We're talking about a legislative proposal to make it easier to commit people with mental illnesses for treatment when they don't want to seek it. It's 1-800-242-2828. 1-800-242-2828 in the Twin Cities, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. We're going to go to Wendy in Duluth. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi. I work in the mental health field, and I also am a family member, and I oppose this legislation by Mindy Greiling. I, first of all, want to say that I applaud you, Mindy, for looking at what can be done for early intervention, but I don't think this proposal is the answer. And then the second thing is that I want to correct you. When you said depression is not one of the illnesses that could get you committed, and people are aware of it when they have depression, that is totally not true. People can become psychotic when they're depressed as well, and it's a very serious illness, just as manic depression and schizophrenia are. My opposition to this bill, however, has basically to do with the fact that we need to work together to all the advocacy groups and consumers and providers to do something to address early intervention that isn't restrictive, and commitment is restrictive. We would have commitment after commitment if we pass this bill, and there is no money to pay for that kind of thing. And if we did have money, what we need to do is pour it into services like housing. We also have something in Duluth called the ACT team. It's a sort of community treatment team, which helps people who are in need of treatment, and it keeps them out of the hospital.
All right, Wendy, I thank you for your call. Representative Garland.
Wendy, I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about the clinical depression. I certainly know that that's one of the three big serious and persistent mental illnesses, and you could be committed for that. I just meant to say that you're more apt to recognize that you have a mental illness if you have clinical depression than with the other two big ones, bipolar and schizophrenia. There are many things we can do in the community. I'm committed to working on more funding. We need to work on all those things. But I think that we also have to recognize that for those who don't recognize that they're ill, we also have to have early intervention. And for those people, the streets could be lined with gold with all kinds of welcoming community care, and they wouldn't access it. And I think that we need to help those people because they need to lead a life of dignity as well.
Cynthia Nugent-Hart.
Wendy mentioned that one of the problems with the bill is that there is no money attached to this, and that is one of the objections of the folks that are opposing it at this time. The bill, although it's an optional thing that the counties could implement the new language, if they did, it would dramatically increase the number of people who are subject to commitment, which puts a tremendous burden then on social service, court, and hospital costs for counties. Since there is no funding associated with this and we have limited resources, this would siphon money into the courts and away from non-coercive forms of treatment. And I would also say that if it's not used, you know, then what's the point of making all these changes?
We're going to go to Roger in Roseville. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Thank you. To me, it seems unethical and immoral that volunteers receive priority for treatment over non-volunteers who may be in more serious trouble and need treatment most. For example, of 300 different psychiatric diagnoses, about 150 really don't need drug treatment and can benefit just by counseling. Yet they're more willing to volunteer for accepting treatment. Whereas a diagnosis of a more serious nature amongst the thought disorders such as the schizophrenias or mood disorders such as major depression or manic depression, where there is a reluctance problem and the potential for suicide is very high. For example, 15% of those with the diagnosis of manic depression commit suicide. And in most cases, it really takes more than 72 hours to properly diagnose, stabilize, and treat people with schizophrenia, major depression, or manic depressive episodes. I think we should give the psychiatrist an opportunity for them to do their job and reluctant participants in treatment an opportunity to live a longer life.
Roger, I thank you for your call.
Roger, thank you for that comment. I just want to clarify, this is really not distinguishing between people who have less serious forms of illness and more serious forms of illness. And it's important to note that the current laws do provide for, you mentioned 72 hours. One can go in on what's called a 72-hour hold and begin to receive the treatment that they need. And there is provision in the current law for the use of medications in emergency situations. So we already have some protection, though, you know, it's fair to say that this obviously doesn't fill the need. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here talking here. But there is some protection for a short-term intervention of that sort. We're going to go to Nancy in Minneapolis. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a psych nurse in a large metropolitan hospital, and I have been for about 10 years. And I am just furious this winter at a scam that I see going on, and I can't believe that the doctors allow this, but a patient will come, or a person will be on the street, and they'll be homeless, and they're drug addicted, and they're having family problems. Their family kicks them out. They have no home. They have no job, and they're out of drugs. So what do? They come into the emergency room, and they say, I'm suicidal, or I'm having voices. Well, there's no blood test, and there's no X-ray test to dispute this. That's all they need to say, and that's their ticket in, and they've got anywhere from a week to 4 weeks of free board and care and free narcotics. And just recently now I had a patient that was for 4 weeks was in and was getting painkillers every 4 to 6 hours, narcotics. And nobody believed that he was really in pain. He just he liked the drugs. And it was just, it's
Nancy,
very frustrating.
Nancy, tell me how this relates to the question of commitment.
Well, actually, it's a question of finances and,
okay.
and that I see that I really am compassionate to all the people that need help, but I see this huge scam going on, and it's infuriating.
Thanks for your call, Nancy. Kevin in Deep Haven.
Oh,
hello. Hello. Welcome to Mid-Morning.
Hi. I've been on a lot of the sides of this issue. I'm actually a caregiver at this point, but I've been committed, or no, actually was a voluntary patient for a while. And I've got a couple different points to make.
Can you make them quickly?
Yeah. The one point is that the cost of mental illness, and I didn't listen to the beginning of the show, but they're pretty high in this country. I think for schizophrenia alone, it's an estimated $50 billion a year between lost wages and actual medical treatment costs are spent. And I think that that's an important thing for anybody in the community to know that this is an issue that does hit us all one way or another. The other thing that I wanted to point out is that, I mean, mental illness, I think, is something that can be treated, and people can recover from it.
Kevin, I'm afraid that we have run out of time. I do want to thank you for your call in the seconds that we have remaining. Mindy Greiland, can you tell me, are there going to be more public hearings? Is there going to be more discussion?
I think this will be a discussion that takes place in the next legislative session. The civil law chair has told me that this is too controversial to deal with in the limited amount of time left this year.
All right. And Cynthia Nugent-Hart, can you tell us how the opposition will be shaping up then?
Well, I am really hoping that we can have many, many more discussions to look at ways to accomplish what the representative wants to do outside of the context of the commitment law, because I think we really need to ask ourselves, you know, is it appropriate to be forcing people into a treatment system that has so many gaps and deficiencies as opposed to taking steps to force the treatment system to provide appropriate services.
Mindy Greiland, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Catherine.
Mindy Greiland is a state representative from Roseville. Cynthia Nugent-Hart, thank you for showing up today.
Thank you very much.
Cynthia Nugent-Hart, a member of the State Advisory Council on Mental Health. Make sure you stick around for the second half of Mid-Morning. Do you think there are too many frivolous lawsuits in Minnesota?